This is the Knowledge Bandits Podcast, and I'm your host, Arun Galadima. Let's start the show. This is the Knowledge Bandits Podcast, and I'm excited to bring you today's guest, Ms. Uduak. She is a partner and co-founder of Ebitu Law Group, whose practices include contract drafting, negotiations, business litigation, intellectual property, fashion, and entertainment law. Uduak, I've given a very, very brief introduction, but can you take the time to let the bandits get to know you a little bit better?
Sure. Wow. Where do I start? I used to define myself with so many titles, but I think now the easiest definition is that I'm a creator and a business owner. And part of that creation or being creative is the different angles, particularly media publishing and then business owner dealing with the fashion and entertainment as well.
Nice, nice. And so can you take us through a little journey of your background? Let us get to know how you got to where you are. What did you study? All of that stuff.
Okay. So I was born in San Jose, California. Yay. And when I was a child, my family, specifically my mom, returned back to Nigeria with the kids. And my family is from what is now the South, used to be the East, the Akwa Iboms. But prior to that, it was just Calabar, right? So it was split down the line. And so she decided that she wanted to raise her kids in Lagos. So I grew up in Lagos. And I actually had no clue I was Calabar. I thought because I speak, read, write perfectly Yoruba, I thought that I was Yoruba the whole time. And what was also interesting was I didn't know, not till much later, about my paternal side of the family in terms of a deep entrenchment in the legal industry, whether it's talking law enforcement, the judiciary, or just, you know, professor or practice of law, period. But I read a Yoruba book, my love for Yoruba, right, when I was in primary school and fell in love with the characters and even more specifically, the judicial system that was outlined in the Yoruba book. Right then and there, I knew I wanted to be a lawyer. I didn't know what that was called, but that advocacy, I wanted to do it. I felt the sense of injustice in reading the book and wanted to save the person, the young maid that was accused of stealing from her master by the wife. So it was so interesting and it resonated with me. And then I'd find out much later that I was actually Calabar, and I wasn't even Nigerian. I didn't even have a Nigerian passport. I was an American. So much later, and as an adult, I found that the theme or underlying theme of my life has been that of identity. Like, how do you really define yourself and who are you? And so whether I'm advocating in a courtroom or outside of, or sharing stories about identity, that's the underlying theme, or speaking and speaking engagements. Like, once you know who you are, I believe things fall in place. And there's not that internal constant conflict or things that one might tell, you know, themselves. So in terms of the legal career, I just know unequivocally based on certain life experiences. So I ended up growing up in a single parent home with my mom raising four kids herself. And I don't know how she did it, but just to think about the fact that she sent all of us to private schools and really imparted a lot of education, knowledge, and things that I took for granted. But now it's like, oh, wow, she just was phenomenal. But I knew unequivocally that I was going to be a lawyer and nothing was going to get in the way. Absolutely nothing. And so everything, you know, I used to be in for at some point I lost that vision, but thankfully it's back now. Life experiences and trauma, you know, dealing with that. But I've always been someone who knows what I want, how I want it, and where I want to go. And people who come into my life somehow think that's not the case, especially when you're dealing with patriarchal society where they just think women change their minds, you know, all the time. But they're in for and usually experience a lot of rude awakening. You're not going to change my vision from 20 years because I know where I'm going. The question is, how do I get there? So, yeah, that's in a nutshell who I am.
Nice, nice. Wow, so much you said, a lot that really lets us get to know who you are a little bit better. So knowing that you always wanted to become a lawyer, when did you figure out where you wanted to go to school?
Well, in terms of law school?
Yes.
Okay. So maybe in connecting the dots a little bit for your listeners. So my mom was concerned about the educational system in Nigeria before it got bad. The system is really just absolutely excellent. Mm. And she basically had read a particular article, which she cut out and kept for over 2 years, about some sort of forecast of potential economic decline and recession, as well as educational system just going to go down. So she said, in a nutshell, it's not going to be that kind of party for my kids. Mm. And what she set out to do was to work towards bringing us back to the States. So in 1991, lo and behold, there's a whole backstory that's just too long to get into. I was sharing it just recently that my brother used to go. So my brother, he's the oldest, and we're total three girls, one boy. And he studied at Hope Waddle, which is in Calabar, in a boarding school. For whatever reason, he decided to sneak out of the school and go to JUS to play basketball. So he's now 6'9", and he was growing really tall back then. So anyway, an incident happened, unfortunately, where my the person who was visiting in JUS, my uncle, got robbed. So when my mom found out, she was like, okay, that too is not happening. So he was a major incentive, and then also that article that she cut out of the newspaper. So fast forward 2 years later, I come from school, literally, and my mom's like, we are going to the United States of America. And that's exactly what we did. She took her kids back to the States. And so my reality, knowing that I always wanted to become a lawyer while I was in Nigeria, I went first to Gideon International Children's School in Isala. And then from there, also went to Command Ikeja, which was a day school. So every situation and every opportunity, I was the one starting debate clubs. I was debating. I learned how to read and write, really. And debate through reading and writing and watching a lot of debate. You know how they have those debate competitions on television, local television, watched a lot of that. And then when I returned to the States, it wasn't a question. I knew that's where I was headed. So everything about my life was orchestrated towards that. How do I get there? And everything I did literally was towards that. Continued to join debate teams in college, certainly did that in law school as well. And just carved out and mapped out exactly where I was going, because I knew I wouldn't get there.
Nice.
So law school was just, I applied to 11 schools. I had my heart set on Loyola because my brother went to Loyola Marymount and played basketball there for them on a scholarship. And I was just in love with the campus, the school, everything. And then a few weeks, I went down there, saw the school, applied to 11 schools, got into 9. I was content. And then a few weeks before school started, a friend of mine in the Bay Area, because I was in San Jose, said to me, can you come with me to Berkeley for one of those law school, you know, career oriented days because I'm surveying schools, law schools that I want to go to. So I went with him. And to make the long story short, there was a guy there, Keith, and Keith Darcy. And he was with UC Hastings School of Law. And he came to me, we went to his, you know, booth. And he was so interested in me attending Hastings. And I said, no, I'm going to Loyola. I love Loyola. And I went on and on and on. He's like, no, you need to come to Hastings. I'll tell you what, I said, even if I was going to come to Hastings, just a couple of weeks, school starts. He says, send all your application. I think the deadline was literally right about the corner or something. And show up, make an appointment with me, show up. I'll show you around the school. You need to come to Hastings. So I did. I showed up, took me out to lunch, showed me around the school and said, you are going to come to Hastings. And for me, the ultimate decision was the cost of education. Hastings was so cheap. Not only was it much cheaper, it was also a top tier school, you know, at the time, ranked in the top tier. So I said, gosh, it's close to home. cost-wise, it's pretty cheap. Of course, I'm going there. And then after my first 2 years, I ended up transferring as a visiting student to Georgetown Law where I finished.
Nice. Wow. Yeah, so many things. That's really interesting how you seem to have this sort of drive that, you know, it's very interesting. You don't find a lot of people that have it, but you've set your mind on something and you see it all the way through. Now, I want to ask, so many people want to do that. It's not that people don't want to do it, but there's so many distractions along the way and you get pulled from left to right and just sort of breaking the flow a bit. How do you stay focused on one thing? Can you give people a little bit of insight as to how you've been able to do that throughout your life?
Well, one of the things that I know I mentioned having a detour to some extent, I never understood when people could not see vision and achieve what they wanted, because for me, I just thought everybody was that way until a personal experience on childhood trauma that I literally buried for so long got triggered. And when that was triggered, nothing mattered. I needed to go and deal with that interpersonal issue. And so the distraction. I mean, so I can relate to people not necessarily seeing vision for whatever reason, whatever that distraction may be. And for me, when the distraction wasn't there, I looked, what drove me was that I believed that I could live in a society where there was gender equality for women, gender equality for girls. Growing up in the 80s in Nigeria, and your mother is practically the only single married but single mother on the block, it comes with certain things, and it comes with a lot of disrespect sometimes, particularly for men. And I didn't want to experience that. And I didn't also think, and not disrespect to the child because we're children, but to, you know, seeing how your mom is, you know, because there's no man around, or her thoughts are dismissed because there's no man around. And that angered me very deeply. But beyond angering me very deeply, I felt like no child should have to go through that, boy or girl, you know, like voice dismissed because society has determined here's who we are going to accept and whose voice matters. And so I found myself at a very young age knowing that my calling was to advocate for the voiceless unequivocally. And so nothing got in the way, literally. You know, I saw the vision. I'm going to get it. The question is, how do I get it? And in terms of focus and discipline, I didn't need my mom to tell me do this and do that. She, to me, I think what helped me is that she practiced what she preached. She was disciplined. You know, she stayed focused her energies on raising her kids, on being very successful before we left. Ultimately now in the U.S. done her business. I mean, she role modeled it. So when you see someone daily walking with their head held high, shoulders straight, and just handling the business and not complaining, what's your excuse? You get to it. And you get to it because you're an offspring of that person. So she modeled it. And so beyond the fact that that innate drive was there, I also saw an example that solidified for me that this was not negotiable. We're doing this and we're going all the way.
Interesting. And one thing I want to draw from that is I often hear people trying, especially doing this podcast, people look for the most insightful things to say. And obviously it's in audio form, so you want to be as helpful. But one thing to note is that really, the way that you can inspire people and the way that you do inspire people most often is just by the way you live. People around you take notice of certain things. And for you, it was observing how your mom navigated certain situations that gave you the drive and sort of shaped you into who you are today. And I just wanted to point that out, that you often hear people say someone is always watching, and whether it's someone watching you to gain some sort of insight, deeper insight to life, or whether it's you watching someone else and learning from that, just always be aware that your actions are being noted.
Yeah, I'll have to agree with you on that. I think often we look for role models outside of the home. You know, it's that superstar. It's that person on television that we've seen giving sound bites on whatever it is, or appears successful. But really, the role models start in the home. And if you have siblings, parents that are modeling that, then that's what you need. That's your tribe. And they, not only do they have your back, they practice what they preach. So for me personally, people do ask me often, and I've consistently said my mom is my role model. I don't need to look outside for a role model. I appreciate all the great things people are doing, whether it's like the Oprahs of the world or whoever, Elon Musk or whoever. That's cool. That's awesome. But either way, they don't necessarily affect my constitution per se, because in my house, I have that example, so I don't need to go anywhere.
Yeah. And sort of fast forwarding a little bit, skipping some of the salacious details that people might want to hear. When did you start your firm and why did you decide to start it?
Yeah, I started my firm. I've had 3 attempts at starting my firm. The first one was in 2004. And it was more so as a result of just, you know, needed change. And also the company I was working for, things were a little hard in terms of just a challenge of affording my salary. Mm. But it was also time for change. So I decided that it was time to change. And, you know, being an entrepreneur is a good thing. So I started it and, of course, didn't know diddly squat about being a business owner. And just shortly after, went back to the corporate world to work. Mm. And then in a little later, came back and started it, and this time stayed all the way. And then the personal crisis I mentioned that I was going through, it was so impactful on me, the childhood trauma, when I started to deal with it, that I knew that I needed to take a break from everything and just deal with the inner self. I always talk a lot. To me, that's so important, again, based on what I saw modeled. So dealing with the inner child, the inner self, to just sort that out, because it was just getting in the way of everything for me. And then restarted along with a partner, and who happens to be my sister, in 2012.
Hmm. Okay. And you've mentioned, I just want to ask, this personal crisis, is this something that you could share with us?
Absolutely. Actually, okay. I finally got to be able to share it with the public through my platform, Lady Braille Magazine. That was sexual assault when I was in Nigeria by the uncle of my classmate and the nephew of my treating physician. So we went to the same school, and my mom had a thing about, if I'm not around, stay indoors. But, you know, parents don't necessarily tell you why. They just say stay indoors. And if you're at that young age, you want to play and spend time with your friends. So after we're done with our assignments and our chores, we, of course, headed to my friend's place to spend time. And that uncle, you know, unfortunately violated me. But you know what? I didn't think about it. It just, you know, I was more afraid about disobeying the rule of staying indoors. And then I just talked it away and never dealt with, didn't even tell my family, didn't tell anyone. So at the height of success, if you will, then somehow that got triggered, and then I just had to deal with it, you know, to do that. I wish there was a Me Too movement back then, because then you wouldn't feel so silent, so ashamed, and so isolated. Because, of course, as you know, within Nigeria and a lot of Africa, and even here in the U.S., there is a culture of silence. Yeah. So I had to deal with that. So that was that. And I'm glad, because in terms of dealing with that, because it started to help me understand myself a lot more and patterns. You know, I'm ferocious. Interestingly enough, also, you know, always wanted to be one of the boys, I guess, as a sense of protecting. And so it just helped me understand my patterns and understand myself a lot more.
Wow. That's...
You got time? Because we're going to go deep. We don't do that surface kind of stuff.
No, I love it. I love it. Because these are the things that people are dealing with on a regular basis. And sometimes it might not be as extreme as something you're going through, but I was talking to a friend recently, and they were sort of saying they've had such an easy life, but sometimes they feel like there have been things that have happened to them in their lives that they haven't dealt with, but because they haven't had such a tough life, they should just get over it. But I keep saying your reality is your reality.
Absolutely.
And what you experience needs to be dealt with. So, I mean, something like sexual assault that you went through is, I mean, it's extremely damaging. I can imagine that you tried to just completely erase it from your memory, but like you said, it ended up resurfacing and you had to deal with it. But can you talk a little bit about sort of the importance of that mental health aspect of being an entrepreneur and being a professional in the corporate world?
Well, I mean, I don't approach entrepreneurism the way most people do. I believe that our business values are just an extension of our personal values. Hmm. And so to see success with, and if you track and trace true success, particularly with the most powerful, the most successful, you'll constantly see that they had to do extensive inner work. We'll even use Oprah, since the world seems to know Oprah, and certainly on the African continent, for those who may listen. There's a lot of inner work you just have to do. So often we think that being an entrepreneur is a whole set of rules. Okay, set this up, do this, go here, incorporate, file articles of incorporation, get your business contracts, blah, blah, blah. Of course, those are essential. But what is the vision that's driving the business? What are your values? Why do you have this business? What do you want it to do? Is it impact driven, or is it to just drive up sales, or whatever the case may be? So for me, that's how I approach being a business owner. And in terms of working in the corporate world, that was good to get the experience that I needed in terms of litigation. I love being in the courtroom. I enjoy being in the courtroom, because to me, you're solving clients' problems. And I also love transactional work. So the contract negotiation, deal making, the whole nine yards, because particularly when you spend time in the courtroom, something happens. And I know litigators listening to this can understand, especially if they work on the transactional side as well. What happens is you can see the fire come in before it comes. So you are even more effective to putting out those fires, because you know what that feels like in the courtroom. So, yeah.
Nice.
In a nutshell.
Nice. And you said something that I need to draw out on. You said, you asked the question, what are your values? And I think it's important for entrepreneurs. It's so easy to see dollar signs, see zeros and commas coming at you, and you forget why you're doing what you're doing. But it's always important. I usually walk about 2 to 4 miles every day. And on my walk today, I had to sort of recenter myself. And I was thinking, why are you doing what you're doing? And what do you want out of life? And it happens almost the same way every time I'm thinking of something and I come on and talk to someone and they sort of bring up the same thing that I've been thinking of. So I find it really cool that a lot of people are thinking along the same path, where you're trying to figure out why you're doing what you're doing and how do you maintain on that same path.
Absolutely. And I think in this day and age, that's a critical question. I mean, we have Facebook right now, Mark Zuckerberg dealing with, you know, congressional hearings and having to testify about those value systems. We gave you our trust and we gave you our data. Mm. What'd you do with that trust? Are your values indeed violation just to get the best top advertisers on your platform? Or do you really, really value our privacy? If you don't answer that question, no matter how much revenue you make, ultimately, you're going to have to come back and face that crossroad. Yeah. And you have to reevaluate. Goes back to that identity thing I was talking about. You're going to have to reevaluate who you are individually and how that extends with your vision and how you run your company and how you manage people. And whether you also particularly, and let me speak to this particularly for Africans and even more so Nigerians, because we tend to be very ostentatious and very loud and very, you know, it has to be a Western brand, the whole nine yards. Maybe you don't want to be that big as an entrepreneur. Maybe you do want to have a very hands-on, scaled boutique service that's not this major global enterprise, because maybe, yeah, you think you can handle those value systems, but you've not really been tested. And maybe you do want to be that big. But at the end of the day, you've got to go within and ask those questions.
I like that. I haven't heard that for a while, but it's always good to bring that up. Just because you want to be an entrepreneur doesn't mean that you have to be chasing the billion-dollar vision. Sometimes you can work on a hands-on level. My mother is an entrepreneur and she started a small organization in Nigeria that she's able to directly impact the lives of individuals. And I think it just depends, like you said, on what your values are, who you are as a person, figure that out first, and then figure out how that works into your career, your career path.
Absolutely. And I think your business will guide you too. Once you know what those values are, it will guide you into the growth phase, into scaling up, the whole nine yards, because it'll be so seamless and you just go with that and things fall in place, I find.
Nice. Man, this is great. Dropping knowledge left and right. I'm sure people are pulling out the pen and paper and taking notes right now.
Yeah, and they're probably for the first time getting to know me. They've been behind the scene for so long in terms of who I am. So
yeah. Something else you said earlier was, I mean, it took you three tries to start a business to get to where you are right now. And oftentimes, you were pretty open about saying the first time you failed. And you went back to the corporate world, you went back to the drawing board and tried it again. And I think oftentimes when I ask people what was stopping them from taking that step to become an entrepreneur, you hear it's fear of failure. Now, it seems like that was something that you almost instinctively knew was going to happen. And when it happened, you were like, all right, get back to the drawing board, let's do it again. So
that's interesting. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, but I mean, I do want you to talk about that. Was there this fear of possibly failing when you started, or was that not in your mind at all?
That's why I found it interesting. I didn't even think of failure. All I thought was, okay, I've opened the doors, and what you see, again, employee mentality versus being an entrepreneur, Niger style, you're going to go get the degrees, and then you're going to go work for some top major firm and make all this money and blah, 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 blah. And when I decided to venture on my own, I had not factored the legal value chain of how a client's matter goes from point A to point Z. And even though I read a lot of books, there wasn't really anyone to teach me what that looked like and how to specifically run a business, a law firm. And I extrapolated on how to run a successful business, looking at my mom's business, which is a healthcare business, specifically a nursing business. But, you know, law firm is different. So people weren't just advertising and all that, but people weren't just coming all in. So no one told me that that's not how it works. Yeah. So when that happened, I said, okay, you got to pay the bills. Let's get back to regular work. But when I did it the second time, I was better prepared. I knew that, okay, I needed to think very carefully about the bread and butter, because I was thinking more about the sexy litigation side, the big cases and all that, right? But I needed to think about what can ensure the firm keeps running and running consistently. And so that's what I did. And so I didn't think of it as failing, because it wasn't even maybe 3 months, 4 months, I was out. It just, you know. And certain practices as well, you're a new attorney, so you feel like you don't know that much. And so in terms of charging for your worth, you're instead giving a lot of consultations for free. I don't do free consultations. I just don't, certainly not now. But back then, when I first started the first attempt, at the end of the year, when I was looking at my, annual revenue and everything, I was like, oh my God, I gave the whole store for free, because I was just doing all those consultations and, you know, wasn't having the kind of conversion I would have expected. And a lot of legal entrepreneurs were trained to be lawyers, were not necessarily trained to be business owners. And a lot of people that end up on their own, which majority of the industry is solo practitioners, they experience the same thing, because no one's really said, this is how it should be. Law schools are starting to change and introducing business law courses and how to build law firms. But it was just really trial and error. So in my head, I didn't process fail. I just processed, you know what, time to just get the bills paid and I'll come back to this later.
Interesting. And I want to point out one thing that I didn't hear you say was talk about an embarrassment with failing. And I think that's one of the biggest things. People are not necessarily just afraid of failing. They're afraid of the scrutiny that they'll get, the public scrutiny, the judging eyes, the whatever it is, people talking behind your back. Oh, that person couldn't even stick with a successful business, or whatever the case is. But you didn't mention that at all.
And no.
Again, I was thinking about this today on my walk. And one of the things I thought was, this idea of embarrassment means that at the root of it, I'm not doing what I'm doing for myself. I'm doing it for the approval of others. And it's important to know if you're doing something for the approval of someone else, there are a million and one things you can do out there to gain the approval of someone else. But only you really know what you need to be working on. So focus more on yourself, and the embarrassment will kind of, it might not go away completely, but it'll sort of dissipate slowly.
Yeah, that's interesting. For me, the only failure, which came much later, was when, again, I was forced to start dealing with that childhood trauma. I had buried it so long that it wasn't even in my faculties. I used to be the person where I would say I want to be the next president. People would say, sure, sign me up. Where next? But when I started to deal with that, confront and go through the healing process of that childhood trauma, I felt like a failure. Like, why couldn't I defend myself and do all those things? And then, you know, that starts affecting the thinking, and that translates into other things. So before, you never thought of yourself as failing at anything, but all of a sudden you're doubting yourself and all those other things because you were so ashamed and afraid, like really fearful that people would discover this thing about you, you know, and the stigma that came with it. So for me, that's the core of the failure that I felt that has affected what one may deem as progress beyond all of my achievements. And it was just a lot of hard work to realize whether you're talking financial success, interpersonal success, or whatever, that it all goes back to how do you define yourself? How do you let society define you? Are you the trauma that you've experienced? And for me, the answer unequivocally, yes, I was the trauma that I'd experienced. If I voiced it out, I didn't find it, and everything was new to me as it was unraveling. So that trauma can be, you know, present itself across, you failed at business, you know, you failed at your marriage, you failed, whatever it is. So that was key for me in terms of failure. That's the failure that I processed, and it affected everything because I didn't know where to go to, who to talk to. And regardless of how educated you are, sometimes culture can trump your thing. So you know, okay, you should go seek mental health services or counseling or whatever, but you don't go. And the reason you don't go is because, again, the victim ends up being stigmatized instead. So that was fair for me, and very significant, and affected my whole essence.
Wow. And so is this something that you have completely washed your hands clean of, and you're moving on like nothing ever happened, like you've completely conquered this, or does it still affect you once in a while?
I don't think it affects me once in a while anymore. And I think that's why I can freely share it without fear and the shame and the stigma. Because before, I would never share this. Are you kidding me? I mean, we're on a business show and we're talking to a lawyer who is pretty good at what I do. I mean, that's just what it is. And that's just my nature. I've always been that person where you don't need to tell me I'm good. I know I'm good already. You don't tell me, you don't need to tell me I'm pretty. I know I'm pretty, and all those other things that come with it. And instead of dealing with that, we're talking about the fundamental building blocks that affect the essence of an individual that spill into business and success. Because when you drill down to it, and what I've done and the work that I've done, that's what it's all about. That's what it's all about. It's our values, it's our principles, identities. And if all the people, whether it's your employees, whether it's staff, I mean, third party individuals that do business with you, business partners, etc., if they buy into those systems, have a success business. If they don't, then you have failure. So to know what those systems and values are, you've got to first define it and see it and understand it and get intimate and get vulnerable with yourself and know who you are. And that might materialize in different ways. Everybody has their own journey. But remember, when you first asked me to define myself, I said I used to do a lot of titles. And for some formality, I still do. But overall, how I define myself now is I'm a creator. There's a divine creator, and then he's blessed me to be a creator and a business owner as well. It's no longer about I'm this and that and this and that and that, because those things don't matter in the final analysis.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, there's no follow-up to that. I think that was sort of the drop the mic moment.
Drop the mic. Yeah. It's actually a great song, a K-pop song. You just drop the mic. I'm allowed to go K-pop, right?
Of course.
That's in the entertainment space. And my dance instructor does it so perfectly, and I love how she actually just drops the mic and just bounced to it. So
nice. Well, and see, that's the thing. I think we could go on and on just with you dropping this sort of knowledge, but I'm obligated. There's some questions that people do want to know, just so they can sort of match what they're doing with what you're doing to sort of see where they are along that whole progression of success. So what fires you up in the morning? What is your morning routine, and why is that routine so important to you?
Objection, compound question. No. I'm teasing you. Okay, so what fires me in? I'm motivated by Nigeria's children and women. It's been that way since I was a kid till now. I want to see a society, like I mentioned, that is more equitable, and certainly women voices and children are heard. I just happen to use a different tool to achieve that, which is fashion and entertainment law. And with respect to, and I think fashion and entertainment, very, very relevant, because obviously you find a lot of women in that space. You unfortunately find children too when you're talking about labor laws and fashion industry that are violated, or entertainment law, lots of stuff that shouldn't be going on in the industry that affect women as well. Mm. My routine, I'm usually up at least 5 o'clock in the morning. Wow. And I generally tend to write in my journal, to meditate. That day, maybe I'll be up by 6. And then I always journal, like I said, write in my journal, and then I get my day started, and I juice a green smoothie generally. Mm. And then I spend a lot of time scrolling through the internet for news and just staying updated on everything, because I'm also a publisher. So stay abreast of legal issues, of issues affecting women, leadership, empowerment, the whole nine yards. And then it's time to get myself ready and in my day as a lawyer. And that usually officially starting my day is about 9, and then go till my body says, okay, you can't do this. And then I try to ensure that I fit my exercises in. I've gotten so much better with it. So routinely, I've switched it up a little bit in the evenings. I exercise in the mornings very early sometimes, depending on the time after I'm done with that routine. I hit the gym and exercise. That's essentially my day. Yeah.
Nice.
And I play some ball, because that releases a lot of stress for me.
So a big part of being an entrepreneur is the passion that people have. That generally sustains them. But obviously, as an entrepreneur, you need the income to sustain you as well. So working, having your own firm, of course, it's sustaining your lifestyle. But how long did it take from start until you were able to sustain the current lifestyle that you have right now?
Well, it's only 5 years. They say successful businesses break right about the fifth to seventh year. Mm. So we're still, I'm an underpaid worker. We're still building, and you know, there are challenges with growing a firm that comes with the territory. And so in terms of lifestyle, I know it's been about simplicity. So I was raised to be simple, and so I don't live an ostentatious lifestyle. And I just keep growing my firm. So that's where I'm at. Hmm. So I don't know in terms, I don't, you know, when you say lifestyle, my lifestyle is very simple. Hmm. I don't purchase things I can't afford. And I just take things one day at a time. And for my business, I a lot of reinvesting in my business and take very little out, if at all. So yeah.
Hmm. Nice. That's probably one of the best pieces of advice my parents gave me. They said, always live below your means. And that, of course, sounds very obvious, but the older you get, and especially in the U.S. where you can get credit cards, you find that a lot of people find it difficult to live below their means. But I think even as an entrepreneur, when you're getting to the stage where you might want investors, That's one thing that they're going to look at. They're going to look at your lifestyle and see if we give this person money, are they going to be frugal and be responsible with the business, or are they just going to try and blow it on themselves? So,
yeah, I mean, we didn't get into the business side of things in terms of like just core substantive business talk, but I was just giving a business related seminar yesterday similar to that. One of the things that we have the illusion with as businesses is that because you can have XYZ invest maybe 10 million seed funding or whatever that is, that means you've arrived. The reality is that it's not the case. The investors want a return on investment, but beyond that, sometimes investors are having to borrow money in order to invest in you. So just because someone is a VC doesn't mean that that money actually belongs to them. They actually sometimes having to take loans out in order to fund your business because in it and think you can they can make as much money and all this other thing. So it's always about a calculated risk and everything else with it. And people have a lot of illusions and don't know what the back end is. I remember when I started to do journalism work, and had the opportunity for mainstream American media and had the opportunity to be in spaces that was just major. I'm talking about Hollywood at the time and still to a large extent, you know, New York and circles, all the top shows and all this other stuff. What was very shocking to me was to realize how broke a lot of the celebs were. I was just shocked. I don't know why I didn't but, you know, now I understand the camera a little bit more. Could you take a small space and make it look like it's larger than life? But when you meet that person in person, it's just a little room corner that they painted a nice a nice background and filmed for 1 or 2 minutes, add music to it, a little editing, and now you're like, wow, you're so successful. But what celebs do and realize is, how do I create more brand value? And that's where the media comes into play, by really marketing and amplifying themselves out there. So we need to stop this constant trying to live our lives through what other people are doing and figure it out for yourself. What works for you? What works for your business? What works for you individually? But in the business sense, you know, who are the people on your level? Oprah has done what she's done to get to the top. Well, a room is here. Why are you skipping him when he's the future Oprah? You know what I mean? Like, work with people on your level as well. Stop constantly thinking you have to go from here to Richard Branson or whatever, and they are going to tell you how to just build a super successful business, and you have no reality of their story. You just want to, you know, enjoy the glory and say, oh yeah, associate and affiliate. So that's super, super important. We need a reality check as business owners and entrepreneurs on what it really means to be business owners. And I think when we do that, life gets a lot better.
And obviously the most important thing to pull out of what you said is that Arum is the new Oprah. And I hope God heard you too.
Of course.
Amen.
You gotta say amen to that. Then when you do that, then it comes to fruition.
Into existence. Yeah. And so being an entrepreneur, there are certainly those high points that you experience, but they're also the low points. And we've touched a little bit on that briefly, but I was wondering if you can take us exactly to a point, maybe something we talked about earlier, maybe something completely different, but talk about what it was like during that moment, possibly a time where you felt like you might not be able to go on, or you didn't want to do this. You just wanted to drop everything and go travel across the world or go to the far corners of wherever.
So I'm a fighter. I was born to fight and hard. And I'm the kind of fighter where I may not start the fight, but if you start the fight with me, I'm not letting go. We're going to finish it. And that's what litigators do. That's what trial lawyers do. So there was, now let's put that to the side. And then the second part is, I'm of Nigerian heritage. So even though I'm American, I guess, I am American. I grew up in Lagos, as I said. So I had no true sense of racism. Like many Africans who relocate back or born over there, spend time, whatever. The point is, we often tend to not realize that there is, in fact, racism. And I had this grand when you hear how I talk about the law and how passionate I am and what I want to do with it. So I had this illusion that what I studied in school would translate outside, and that it's about fairness and equity and all this other great, awesome things. I need to be dropped right in the middle of it and realize that, what? Welcome to the real world. It's art. Nasty and dirty, and people do what they have to do sometimes to win, including screwing over and your client over or attempting to. So it was the first time I ever experienced it, roughly about 2007 or 8, and it struck me to the core because I was just so innocent, if you will, about the reality of the practice of law and what attorneys and sometimes, you know, people that shouldn't be doing things end up doing. So make the long story short, that was so shocking to me and made me really, I lost the taste to practice law. I lost the interest, and I'm very passionate about it. And so a long time prior to, I read a book about a letter to a young poet by, I'm not sure if you've read the book called Letters to a Young Poet. The book is by Raina Maria Rilke.
Okay.
I think that's how you say the last name. And basically in that book, he's giving advice, or she, I don't even know if it's a she or he. I just happened to read it a long, long time ago. And the advice was the young man was asking, what do I do? Do I quit this profession of being a poet? Blah, 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 blah. And the advice was, if at the end of the day, in the stillness of, you know, your own solitude, no one around, and it's just you against the world and your thoughts. If you think about the profession you're in, being a poet, and you believe you can live without it, then go ahead and quit. But if you believe that, no, you can't, then you're meant to stay and be that poet. And so it stuck with me. I read it a long time ago. Actually, it was just a few lines that the designer I was modeling for had shown me. She was reading the book, and I asked her what it was, and she told me and then showed me this line. I was like, wow, that's so profound. So it was stored in my memory bank. And so when I ultimately faced this issue and had such restlessness and such distress and really thought about quitting the practice of law, I went back to that and I said, law is me, I'm law, and it may not always be litigation. Certainly, I was very interested in policy issues and actually a senatorial run, which is, and becoming a senator, which is why DC was very attractive to me and why Sacramento is still attractive to me. But I ultimately just came to the conclusion that I can't do without law. My heart, my blood is law. And therefore, we're going to keep trucking away and doing this. So at that point, took a little while, I must be honest. And that's when I got re-energized and fell in love with law all over again and just said, okay, let's do this. Let's go full court press, right? Since we're talking basketball on the side as well. So that's essentially that moment for me where I thought about quitting.
Yeah. And I like how you faced this challenging moment. You were thinking of giving it all up, but then you thought back to why you were doing what you were doing. And I think it's sort of that fighter spirit that a lot of us do have. And being an athlete, I have that same mentality where it's like, oh, someone else wronged me or someone else did something. I'm not going to give them the satisfaction of them being the reason that I stopped doing this. If I stop, it's going to be because of me, not because of any external circumstances.
Exactly. And you will have those days where, whether you were talking about, for example, the life of entrepreneurs, where you would have days like, okay, where is that next income going to come in? Whether it's to pay staff, take care of yourself, and this other things. It's just real. You know, I was on LinkedIn not too long ago, and I saw a fellow publisher, and he was responding to one of those guys that does the Shark Tank, I think. Those VC pitching shows. Anyway, and the guy was talking about how you follow your passion. And so this other guy responds saying he used to believe in that. No, he doesn't anymore. Passion doesn't pay the bills and blah, 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 blah. And I said, passion doesn't pay the bills. True, but both can coexist. And the reason why they can both coexist is that often all we hear only is about follow your passion, follow your passion, follow your passion. Let's start asking the deeper question of, in following your passion, what did you have to give up? And journalists and podcasters and all kinds of people need to be asking those questions, just like you've asked, right? What did you have to give up? What marriage broke? You know, what marriage failed? What relationship with children is non-existent because you spent all your time as an entrepreneur? What romantic relationship did you not pursue because you couldn't just balance the work-life balance kind of situation? We need to be asking those things. What about mental health and all those other things? What about the income and the stress that goes with it? Talk about it. We just want to talk about the glory and yay, things were awesome and all that. So, you know, we need to, again, drill down and be very real. And success does ultimately come. So it is a positive, right? But the point is, let's do the work so that down the line, we don't have to come back and do the work.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that. Just this idea of balancing things out, because yes, of course there's passion, but you also have to be realistic with your passion. And, I like that statement, but I'd add to it. You said, this VC or investor said, passion doesn't pay the bills. But I would counter that with saying, yeah, but money doesn't pay the soul. So you have to really balance both of it.
Look at you dropping wisdom. Whose interview is it? No, I'm teasing. Go ahead.
I mean, you had one mic drop. I had to have one.
I know, right? Come back at me. That is amazing. Please repeat that. That was really good.
Yeah. So I said, passion doesn't pay the bills, but money doesn't pay the soul.
Did you trademark that?
You know what? I think I'm going to do it right now.
Well, before you do it, I'm going to rip it off you.
Yeah. I'm really at your mercy now. You're the business lawyer. You're the copyright lawyer.
Yeah, no joke, right? Now I'm going to get it. Yeah. Very, very, very powerful. Definitely.
And I think you have this really good ability. Whenever I ask about a downtime or we talk about a difficult time that you faced, you go right into the positivity. So I'm really excited to see what you'll say about talking about one of the sort of most, I guess, euphoric moments that you've felt as an entrepreneur so far, a point where you were just like, this is exactly where I need to be. This is exactly what I need to be doing.
I think that just happened a few days ago. I just was smiling and just said, this is it. It feels right. One of the things I didn't mention was I've always been about freedom, free will, freedom. I think that comes with the childhood I explained to you, particularly on the side of growing up in a single parent home. I always wanted to be free. I never wanted my voice, just everything about me restricted. So I knew that no matter what, at some point I'll have my own business. And one of the main reasons for that was I don't believe that we're born to just choose only one thing in life. I just don't know where that concept came from, but I really don't believe it. So as a creator, I like to tell stories. There are two ways I tell stories: through the media and through law, whether advocacy for someone else or telling stories in interviews, writing, etc. And if you are working for other people, it's very, very hard to have the freedom to tell stories, whether your own stories or stories of other people. And those stories need to be told, especially the African story. The African narrative needs to be like flipped over, upside down and just completely changed, especially in the diaspora. So for me, I always knew that I was going to be an entrepreneur and that no matter what the challenge is, that I would ultimately keep going. What I've had to learn is to make sure that I'm flexible to where that road leads me. Before, I thought it only had to be in the courtroom. As I matured more, I realized, no, that's too limiting. It can be everywhere, and it should be everywhere. Was that answer to your question?
Of course. I mean, that's great. I'll just pull off one thing. I remember I was talking with my dad a little while ago, when he sort of switched from a professor to working in the more administrative side of academia. And I remember asking him, oh, is this great? And he's just like, you know, it's really weird being older, but I feel that God has called me to move to these different places. And even I think he was maybe like 53 or so at the time. He said, it's really interesting that you find yourself having to learn new skills and essentially start a new career at different points of time in your life. And I think that's really what you're sort of getting at as well, is this idea that you have to do one thing for the rest of your life isn't necessarily true. And I think it's just
not normal. It can't be normal.
Mm.
You know why? Because when you look at the people who are successful, go through their career paths, they didn't stop where they ended up. And the really smart ones diversify their portfolios. There's so many income streams coming in. Yeah. But we just happen to see them really branded as, for example, Richard Branson with the airlines and you know, that whole product line and flights and the whole nine yards, the airline industry. Mm. But look at Oprah. We know her as a talk show host, but she's now a media magnate, media mogul, and she's got published on books, on and so many other streams of income. And she's, of course, a philanthropist as well. Mm. Don't pay attention to those details. We just define one thing, but nobody really does just one thing.
Yeah.
It's just what they're most known for.
Yeah.
I recently found a new group called More Than Just Esquire. And it's co-founded by two Nigerian ladies. And I just was like, wow, this is awesome. And they understand that concept. So it's a platform that's only focused on attorneys across the globe, in the U.S. and across the globe, who do more than just be lawyers. Hmm. You know, it's very, very limiting for someone to say you can only do this one thing. To me, it makes no sense. We're not born to just do only one thing. Now, if you do only one thing very, very, very well and you enjoy it, great. You make that choice for yourself. But for others to say, we're not going to offer you opportunities or do that because you have to narrowly define yourself as one thing, or as you're confused, you don't know what you're doing, and why can't you just focus, and all this stuff that a lot of people, creatives particularly, have heard. Mm. That doesn't make sense, you know? Yeah. And I think we've moved from an era of, first it was generalist and specialist. We're going back to an era of generalist, where you have to know a little thing here and there about everything, but then be absolutely amazing at that one thing that you know.
Yeah.
You know.
Hmm. And I think sort of my mind just went to two places, actually. First, it went to Kanye West, and oftentimes you'll hear him in interviews saying, when he started making beats, people told him he couldn't do that. But then he said he wanted to rap, and people said, no, you're a producer. You just stick to that. And people all along the way were trying to stop him from doing whatever it was he wanted to do. So it's just a little bit more encouragement to say, like, you can do different things. You can spread yourself and not sort of be bound to one thing. And I have a friend, actually, who is in Chicago. He's a lawyer as well, and he's a lawyer by day, but at night he's a boxer / MMA fighter. And I find that to be such a really cool combination.
Yeah, there's a guy I read about, I think it was in Chicago or Michigan, that was daytime, worked with the top firms, at night he was a hip-hop artist. That was so cool.
Wow.
He was profiled in the ABA some years back. But yeah, we can do different things. And one of the things too that you'll see as well is that they come in phases as well, right? That growth, the thing you were saying about your dad as well. So they also come in phases. Sometimes it's not all at once. It's just, this is the next chapter in your life, and you're just embracing that creativity or that side you've always had that you never harnessed, and now you want to do that. So feel free to get to know you more and diversify the options that are available to you without feeling like you're not focused, you're confused, you don't have a passion. Find your passion, kind of thing.
Yeah. Wow. Nice. And I think that's a perfect way to segue into the rapid fire round. Are you ready?
I thought we were done. No? No. Yes, I am.
All right. What would you say was initially stopping you from taking the step to become an entrepreneur?
That's an interesting question. I don't think that, well, I guess let me answer it this way. I guess thinking of going the traditional route, like I had to follow the script on what a successful lawyer looked like, which was to go work for others and go up the firm ladder and all that. Maybe. Like I had to follow the script. Otherwise, you know, maybe I didn't know how to be a lawyer because I had to first go work for others. I don't know if that makes sense what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, it does. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what would you say is your superpower as an entrepreneur?
I'm a connector. I love to connect people. I really do. Hmm. What I hope happens when I do the connections, for example, I have Africa Music Law, my platform. And because of articles that I've written, I'm here in the US doing a lot of referrals to attorneys locally over there because people constantly come for me. I could easily say, no, I'm not interested and I can't help you. I'm in the US. But, you know, I've done that and continuously done that for years now. And so many other things. I just love connecting people. It doesn't make sense to me that you have a certain need. I know someone who can fulfill that need and I can't connect you. Now, not to be confused with, I don't like users. So I definitely vet because these are relationships I've built over time. So you're not just going to come in and, you know, with me not knowing you or potentially undermining that relationship. But I'm a connector, and I think that comes into play as an entrepreneur because that translates to being able to go out and sell, go out and build relationships. So I like to connect people.
Nice. And what quality do you think you need to improve on most as an entrepreneur?
I wish I inherited my mom's super organizational power. I'm very organized, but I want to be even more organized than I already am. My mom is super organized. Nothing goes by her with her business. And I love that. And I used to be on that level and I don't know what happened, but I want to go back to it. I really, really enjoy just being able to be as organized as possible. I've gotten rid of just feeling so happy and like I've achieved something when I, you know, take my pen and mark off that checklist. I'm no longer about that, but I definitely want to be organized because when you really think about entrepreneurship, the core, I think, particularly beyond the values and stuff that I've talked about, is having very solid business systems operations. Right. So when you have that, it's almost a rinse and repeat for certain services or products that you offer. So how do you make that really tight, that operations part in an organization? And I'm obsessed with trying to improve that and incorporate a lot of technology to help me do that, because I really, really believe that the legal profession is experiencing a lot of disruption and that there's more to come. And we're not going to practice law the way we currently are, even within the next 5 years. I want to be ahead of that. And a big part of that is really, really, really getting organized and using technology to achieve all that. We have clients in outside of California. And we've worked with clients also outside of the country. So guess what? they don't have to come to the office here. We can work with them anywhere. And that's because technology allows us to streamline all those things. Our discussion right now via Skype, you know, so I'm always interested in what are the apps and technologies that can help me really, really have a strong, amazing business at the core foundation. So that the other stuff is really plug and play, and then I can focus more on the experience, enhancing the experience for the client.
Nice. And what is the best advice you've received, and who is it from?
My mom. I never forget it. She says that no matter what, never let other people feel that whatever it is, whether it's a flaw in your life or whatever issues you're going through, that yours is worse than theirs. You know, like you might have a character issue, you might have a problem somewhere, and somebody else thinks because you have a particular issue, that means that they are more superior than you. She always emphasized that to all of us. Never, never let anyone basically make you feel less than because they try to amplify maybe an issue you may have. Own the issue, work on improving it, but never let anybody, you know, beat you over the head with that.
Nice. And what are you reading right now?
I'm one of those people, it's five different at once. So does that count?
Yeah, that counts. We'll get one, okay, though. What is one thing that stands out amongst the five?
Yeah. I went to a conference, one of my friends in Silicon Valley, and met this amazing author. I'm currently reading her book, No Ego by Cy Wakeman. And what it is about how to manage organization by leaving the ego at the door. And she's got some beautiful books that come with that. Save the drama for your mama. Your ego is not your ego, and so many really neat buttons. But she's all about reality-based leadership, you know, and how you can own responsibility in leading an organization and definitely getting rid of ego.
Nice. And you said that was No Ego by?
Cy, space, Wakeman.
Okay. And for everyone listening, we'll have that up on the Knowledge Bandits website on Uduak's page.
Oh, yeah. I got a page. Awesome. Thank you.
Yes, everyone gets a page. Woo-hoo! Yeah. And you touched on this a little bit, but what is one internet resource or application that you couldn't live without? Excluding,
I like
Google
Feedly.
And some of the big ones. Okay.
Feedly. Yeah. I aggregate news from everywhere, and in the mornings when I'm reading news, just go to my Feedly account and just read everything I can possibly read. Sometimes just headlines, sometimes getting to the depth of the articles, definitely.
Nice. And what do you do to unwind from a hectic schedule?
I love to dance, which is why I was referencing that Drop the Mic song with that K-pop song. So I love to dance and I love to play basketball. I find that both are very, very relaxing and also keep me very fit. I also love to travel extensively. And I finally love to read. It all started with me with reading and writing. So
nice. Nice. And to close out the rapid fire round, do you feel like you've made it yet?
In what way? Lawyers never answer questions. They just ask questions. So in what way?
Career-wise, do you feel like you've made it?
Career-wise, someone's asked me that. And I say often that my ideal thing would be to be the Supreme Court Justice of Nigeria. I don't know where the journey will take me and where life will take me, but I think if I arrive there, I would feel like I've made it. In the meantime, let's keep working on where this journey takes me. I'm finally at a place where, yes, of course, you have a vision, you know where you want to go, but I'm also open to life's journey and having so much fun in the process while I'm at it. So for me, career-wise, I would have made it if I'm sitting, as the Nigeria Supreme Court Justice.
Nice. And I think that was a great rapid fire round. That brings the end of the rapid fire round. And as we cool down, you mentioned one book earlier.
Oh, this guy's crazy. There's a cool down? Gosh. Okay, go ahead.
I mean, people need time to really capture all of that you've been saying. It's been very intense, and now we're just sort of making it a little bit easy on them.
Okay.
Yeah. So what is one book that you would recommend to the bandits?
Outside of the career, outside of the No Ego book or something else?
Yes.
You know, I'm very interested with the history of music, particularly at this junction in my life. So I've got Jay-Z Decoded that I'm reading, and I've also got, well, you said one book.
Oh, sure. Go ahead.
Clive Davis, I'm almost at the end of it. I'm at the last chapter, Soundtrack of My Life. I really, really enjoyed reading that. So I would recommend that as well.
Nice. And for anyone listening, we'll have both of those books all up on her page as well.
I just made extra money for Jay-Z. Okay, no, let's like, I'm not crazy about Roc Nation in Nigeria and all that. No. Go ahead.
And so we talked very briefly about mentorship, and we touched on it a little bit, but can you sort of give us an idea of what mentorship is to you and how you value mentorship, and also give us who your mentors are?
Yeah, with mentorship, in terms of the practice of law, that's been my biggest challenge, because even though I come from a family on the paternal side with a lot of law, and as I mentioned before, legal history, however, I didn't grow up around that. So because I didn't grow up around that, I've always had to figure out a lot of it on my own. Now, I was lucky to have two amazing mentors, one of which is Donald Temple, and he's out in the Washington, D.C. area. One of the reasons I'm also so in love with DC, he's just a great mentor, but unfortunately not physically here where I could just walk into his office and then, you know, if I call, he's busy with his practice and all that and life as well. But overall, just a phenomenal mentor, and I've been blessed to have him in my life. And then the other mentor, well, two more mentors. The other one was Aubrey Weldon, who's now deceased. May his soul rest in peace. And what he would do, he graduated from Hastings to the Hastings alum. He would just call me randomly. Get out of the office. Come down. Take me to the Fisherman's Wharf or Pacifica and by the water, and take me out to lunch and just, or sometimes dinner, and just have me spill it all out and make suggestions. That was so sweet of him. And I really missed that. That was really nice. He was a few hours away from me, but I didn't mind that drive because, gosh, who takes time out of their schedule to say, come, let me mentor you and show you the ropes. And then, of course, my mom, she, again, in business as well, exemplifies it. She's had over 2,000 employees and the history of her business, and provide a lot of employment and guidance and directions for a lot of people. So it's a good example for me.
Nice. And for those bandits that are listening right now who still have that fear that we talked about earlier, they're afraid to take that step that they know they probably should, what advice can you give them?
Do it afraid. What do you have to lose? You've tried it this way, it's not working. So at some point, you've got to do it afraid.
I like that. And pause for dramatic effect. Do it afraid. Nice. Yeah, so you've talked about your passion and where your passion came from a very early age. You were just drawn to the legal system. You're drawn to justice. Can you talk a little bit about the legal system in Nigeria and sort of give your general diagnosis of what things are, and also a prescription for how things can get better in the future?
Okay. So when I finished law school in the U.S. in 2001, I knew that I wanted to go back to Nigeria and possibly teach constitutional law, comparative constitutional law, where I'm comparing the U.S. and Nigerian law. And so on my own initiative, I just started to study Nigerian law and put myself through all the subject matters that a first-year course would or first-year law student here would, and just download from the Constitution to all kinds of laws and subject matters in the legal field. One of the things that kept coming up for me was to see that, geez, Nigeria actually has an amazing body of law. And yeah, there's some issues here and there, and laws could be refined, and certain laws can be brought into the digital era, particularly when we're talking IP, intellectual property, specific to the fashion and entertainment industry. But even within that context, some of our laws are even more protective of U.S. laws, or more protective than U.S. laws. So for me, I realize it's an enforcement issue. The rules are on the books. There's no question about it. How do we have it be enforced? So I started Lady Bro magazine, as I mentioned, more for the fashion side to destigmatize the image of Africans. I felt that the single narrative of Africans are like we're running around naked in the wild, thanks to Geographic magazine or whatever. So I wanted to change that. So if we're running around naked, and I'm in the fashion industry and my background is as a fashion model turned lawyer, let me do what I know fashion does well, sell clothes by putting the clothes back on Africans and take hold of the narrative. So I started Lady Bro magazine. And in the process of putting clothes back on Africans and reporting on African runway, begging my mainstream editors to allow me to even go all the way to Nigeria to cover stories, to Ghana to cover stories. At the time, no one was doing that. And also finding African stories locally here to get it to be mainstream. In doing that process, contacting record labels at the time, from Chocolate City to Storm Records and so many more, the late Doug Green, saying, give me your sound recordings. Let me sync them with my videos that mainstream media is having me report on. And I have my production team, you know, sync that. That way we can have, you know, a different image of Africans. In the process of doing that, something else I started to notice that happened from the fact. Industry, and then later on, I decided, let me just expand it into the music, was this, that whenever we had problems amongst each other, we would go on social media and go bananas. And our African societies are not used to sort of like burying it out like that, like being so like, you know, really, really, exactly. So the more it happened, and I remember a particular fashion incident that occurred, and I discussed it, and I said, wait a minute. You're a lawyer, you want to make change in Africa. And what's the best tool to do that? It's no longer going to be the civil rights movement that we know here in the States. It's a different kind of civil rights movement. It's a civil rights movement where we've got to plug in and tap into what Nigerians particularly love. And they love fashion. They love everything Western. So if they goof up somewhere, a celebrity goofs up, why don't I build that celebrity culture first with Lady Bro and certainly also with Africa Music Law, and then flip it around and cover the specific bad behavior, celebrity bad behavior, and address legal commentary and analysis that are that bad behavior by looking at U.S. law and Nigerian law. So thankfully, I'd done a lot of studying and continue to do a lot of studying, and that's where I started to, that's where AfricaMusicLaw.com was born. And that was in 2011. And I covered, no one was doing it. I created and covered issues affecting and still do the entire industry. And then wrote a book. So I'm getting ready, God willing, with the right partners this time to publish Nigeria's first ever music industry and law book, which addresses side by side U.S. law, Nigerian law, and covers the entire music business value chain. Everything you need to know, whether it's about music publishing, the recording industry, how to build a business from ground up, whether you're over there or here, incorporation issues, whether you're over there or there. I mean, just extensive. But the way I did it is how you asked me to do it at the beginning, in terms of, hey, tell me your background. I said career or personal. You said both, and interweave it. So that's exactly what I've done, because I don't want a boring read for myself, and I certainly don't think other people should read a boring read. So I literally take people through the streets of Lagos, where I grew up, and my personal experiences, and express this business of entertainment in a way that a seven-year-old Nigerian kid, my primary audience, can understand. Great if the secondary audience of executives and lawyers and all that read and understand it, but I honestly didn't write it for them. Now, what's interesting is, since I've announced it, the people that are coming up to me and want that market research are Americans and American brands that are saying, we want that information. And of course, now that's because now everybody's, you know, realizing that vision I'd been announcing, publicizing, talking about, and writing about. And they're now saying there's a lot of money to be made in Nigeria specifically, in Africa as a whole. Sony's there now, Universal, and the list goes on and on and on and on, Tidal. And so people are coming around. So again, what I found was, let's use the celebrities. Let's talk about their issues. They don't like to be talked about. Let's not make it about gossip, because that's not what we're here for. I'm not here for that. I'm so busy in my life, and I'm not making money off writing about you on AfricanMusicLaw.com. But it's a bigger vision to move the needle forward to the liberation of women and children. And the way I'm going to do it is to get the guys involved, because majority of the guys, 99% of the industry, street art guy. Mm. So all those guys have to come to listen to a woman talk about the industry because she has the knowledge, not because they necessarily want to. And then in the process, I can influence the influencers to influence their own mass crowd. And I'm very proud of the work that I've done. I'm very proud for where African Music Law is. It's been recognized by journals, American international journals. Just this past Friday, unfortunately, I couldn't be there, but American University School of Law honored me for my contributions to the to the legal industry. Mm. And that's huge. Yeah. Emory University has cited me. Emory University School of Law cited me in a legal journal. Mm. I've just been offered so many opportunities, particularly from the academia and speaking and all that. And my vision, hopefully, is to get that book out to the people that I want it to. And then, of course, make the rounds to Western countries that can now have access. But I want to launch first in my country, like Nigeria is still my country. Launch first in Nigeria, because that's what the book was intended for. And certainly go around circles as well. In terms of promoting it. And then after I'm done with that, because again, I believe that the rule of law is already there and what we need is enforcement. I'm really big on getting back in front of the camera, taking those modeling skills and everything else and quote unquote, the pretty face and bring in legal reality type shows on local television over there. Because again, that's the new look for civil rights movement, I believe, in Nigeria, right? Let's get people talking about legal stories. Let's see our courtrooms working. Let's see our judges enforcing the rule of law, much the same way America's taken the entertainment industry and branded itself globally. Mm-hmm. We can do that and change the paradigm for our children and women. So that's my... Well, those are my thoughts when it comes to the law, specific to Nigeria.
Nice. Then I was going to ask, how can, with everything, the burgeoning economy in Africa right now, across Africa, how can we make sure that we are not left out of the financial gain from those things? Because we see a lot of investors slowly trickling in, looking, they do have more expertise. And maybe you can just give one more comment on it, because the foreigners sometimes tend to have a certain expertise that the locals don't. But how can we make sure that sort of the profit is held within Nigeria, held within Ghana, Kenya, these African countries?
The foreigners have expertise, but the foreigners also include people like you and I. And half the time, when we leave that brain drain symptom, we don't look back to the continent, except either to send money home, show up and party like it's 99. We need to be invested in our own communities. We need to take the medical knowledge, the legal knowledge, the music knowledge or whatever, and reinvest in our communities and train. And I know it's very, very hard because my own personal experience, unfortunately, there's that saying that you're not as appreciated in your own father's land or mother's land holds so true for Africans. Going back to that identity thing I talked about, we many times act like we don't love ourselves because you see a room doing what he's doing now. And let's say he sends you a podcast press release of somebody who has just given some amazing knowledge and you run a similar podcast, but guess what? You're not going to share it. Why are you not going to share it? Because, hey, it's competition. Well, how about we just find a way to actually work together where we don't undermine each other? Even if it's not sharing on your platform, it's okay to retweet that. It's okay to share that information so more people are enlightened and educated. And that translates to lifting as you climb in all facets, right? Mm-hmm. I said, I'm a connector. If you have the resource, and I know there's another African brother or sister and non-Africans I do this to as well, why reinvent the wheel? You want a local business locally. There are lots of amazing groups that have started successful businesses in Nigeria or across the continent. If I know them, you're getting into that space. So long as I know there's nothing that about, you know, you that would undermine, you know, the introduction into the space, and that it's about relationships, not just to show up and find out how you can make money, because that's not long-term planning and not relationships. So, you know, to me, that's one aspect. And then the other aspect is, yes, we should collaborate with foreigners as well. But we need to understand deal making. We need to have the basic institutional knowledge we need in the specific areas for us, for those at home, not just only those abroad. We abandon our brothers and sisters at home and focus on accents and all this crap. And we don't train the locals. Train the locals as well. Give them the knowledge that they need. And that way, when they're brokering deals, if you're not around with the funky, amazing American accent or British or whatever, they can still broker deals that are beneficial. Train the lawyers. Lawyers are the deal makers. You know, they should know how to structure all kinds of amazing deals, and a lot of them do. So who are the ones that have been brokering the deals, and how can they pass this knowledge on in a very, very systematic way where, you know, the legal profession is really enlightened and we don't have this repeating itself. And then the creatives know they need lawyers. Lawyers team up with the creatives. We're not back to the same situation. And then, of course, policy. You're in D.C. I'm in Sacramento. Government needs to get involved. And we need to have advocates that are advocating for rule of law and rulemaking generally that favors our creatives and our entrepreneurs. That's how I would answer that.
Hmm. Very detailed. And I'm sure at this point, a lot of people are wondering how they can connect with you.
Okay. I was like, Arun, if you ask me one more question, we're going to have a fight. I am on most social media platforms as Miss Uduak, MSUDUAK. So Twitter, MSUDUAK, Instagram, Facebook. If you are looking to connect with me for purposes of addressing or helping you with a legal matter, then you can email me, and that's UDUAK, the at symbol, EBITU law. grp.com, Uduak at ab2lawgrp.com.
All right, great. And it seems like we might have to fight because there's one final question as we leave.
God, Arun. Go ahead. You're just using me. You want to do a Nollywood part one and part two.
And I have to give credit again to my sister because she's like, why aren't you asking that question? It was one of my favorites. So here it goes. You're tasked with building the greatest business the world has ever seen. You can bring on two people living or dead. Who would you bring on and why?
Wow.
And that's what would you do?
An interesting question. My mom comes to mind because of all the things I've said and how she's done it. And then I need someone who can help me. So she'll come also for the skill sets and institutional knowledge to help me with building. Then I need somebody who will also help with the mind, just pick me up, encourage me, because I think with that, we will be good. Then it will allow me to build a very, very, very strong vision and have this two people help me realize it. Very limited resources, though, with just two people to build this empire. I don't know who the second person is. I haven't thought that deep. Am I allowed not to have a second person?
It can just be you and your mother.
Okay. I know I need someone else. I just don't know who. So let me think through it.
All right.
On the next visit, I'll tell you.
Of course. Well, Uduak, it's been amazing talking to you. I've appreciated it. I've learned so much, and I'm sure the bandits feel the same as well.
Thank you so much for having me. It was an honor. I had a good time.
Great. Stay inspired.
Hey, if you're still there, thanks for listening. If you like the show, please hit that subscribe button wherever you listen to podcasts and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Handle is Knowledge Bandits everywhere. We have closed sessions lined up with some of the entrepreneurs that we've already interviewed. So if you have questions that weren't answered during the show, you'll have a chance to connect with them during these closed sessions. Just go to the Knowledge Bandits website at knowledgebandits.com and sign up for the newsletter on the contact page. If you or someone you know has a business, we'd love to share your story with the Knowledge Bandits community. Just send an email to interview@knowledgebandits.com. If you have a question for me or you want to connect with any of the guests so far, send an email to me personally at arum@knowledgebandits.com.
Stay inspired.